Today, I would like to talk about three issues briefly. First, just brief update on Indonesia. And second, I'll talk a little bit about ASEAN, because I would like to welcome you to look at Southeast Asia region from the ASEAN's perspective, in addition to individual countries' perspective. And then last, but the chunk of my presentation will talk about what happened at the global international trade situation today from the Indonesia's perspective, I would say. But before that, I would like also to say something in line with the U.S.-Indonesia diplomatic relations, that this year we celebrate the 70th anniversary, 70, because this is very historical. The official diplomatic relations between the two countries began in the last week of December 1949, when President Truman at the time sent message to President Sukarno welcoming the new nation into the world of nations, and also asked President Sukarno for the first U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, named Merle Cochran, to present his credentials. The U.S. Was very instrumental in getting Indonesia's international recognition for its independence, because we had the UN good offices at the time that represented by the Netherlands, Belgium, and the U.S. to address the issue of transfer of sovereignty from the Netherlands colonial government to Indonesia. And in the beginning, you can imagine, as a fellow ally, and of course, at the time, it was very much the beginning and a very tough Cold War situation, the U.S. Took side for the Dutch colonial government because of the strategic consideration in Europe. But what happened, every 6 months, the U.S. Delegation to that UN commission had to be replaced, because the person representing the State Department, despite the marching order, was supposed to favor the Netherlands government, always changed side along the way. And after 6 months, always has to be replaced with the new person. And the new person did the same thing. In the beginning, they follow orders, and after 6 months, they took side to the Indonesian position. And that happened until the whole U.S. position changed altogether and took the Indonesian side. And even at one time, the Congress at the time, the U.S. Congress, gave a strong warning to the colonial government, and especially the capital in The Hague, unless the Netherlands took seriously the commitment and the process of transferring the sovereignty to Indonesian government, they will stop the Marshall Plan given to the Netherlands government. And of course, post-World War II in Europe, there was no other resources but the Marshall Plan to conduct government business. So then the Netherlands became more serious, and then everything is falling into the right places. So this is an important historical perspective in itself. Now let me go to the three topics that I mentioned earlier. Now on the Indonesia and its recent development. Indonesia just had a presidential and legislative elections in April this year. It was estimated about 81% turnout. Of course, this is too good to be true for U.S. Context. Or more than 155 million voters cast their ballots in the April election. And that election selected 20,000 parliamentarian seats and from 250,000 candidates. And 40% of the voters are millennial voters between 17 and 35 years old. So this is what happened during that six-hour voting time, not even a whole day, to have that 155 million people turn out. And that is already a remarkable achievement by itself. But if you compare to what happened 20 years ago, where Indonesia was on the brink of collapse and disintegration because of the Asian monetary crisis, because of several human rights related violations events, because of the social conflicts in many parts of the country, because the economy was basically collapsing with the negative growth of 15% in that year. And you look at what happened last April, in not just an isolated case, but as a moving film or movie, that's what I said earlier during the lunch, is as good as beyond Mission Impossible. Because you would not imagine how a country that was almost balkanized and the brink of disintegration just 20 or even 18 years ago became now, officially, and this is my quote, and many Americans don't agree with this, the largest presidential democracy in the world. Because we have 155 turnout voters. With the U.S. Is still dreaming about it. On the economy, Indonesia economy has been growing at a steady annual rate of 5.1%, 5.3% over the last 7 years. And even with the current situation in the global uncertainty, we still keep the growth around 5.1%. It is a better quality of growth at the same time. Inflation is not only manageable at just over 3%, but this year we have managed to have the inflation below that and hovering around 2.5%. The issue of equality always have a big priority in Indonesia, and on that we have improved just a little bit. It's still a long way to go, but at least we can say that the Gini ratio is also down from 0.41% to 0.38%. And the poverty levels have been reduced to a record low below 10%. And in addition, we have the lowest unemployment rate, just over 5%. Now, with that situation, we have been concentrating and allocating the majority of our budget and our other resources toward education, infrastructure development, and health services. However, we still recognize there are new and emerging challenges in Indonesian economy. Among others, how to maintain and improve the competitiveness and vibrancy of the Indonesian industry. The need for greater value added beyond commodity-based products, and improve infrastructure development for the whole nation, which consists of 17,800 islands, not just the island of Java, where 55% of the population live. And also how to promote innovation and technological change and related risks to existing jobs and in traditional economic sectors. And the key factor to all of these challenges is, of course, how to improve the human capital development. Now, while that is the Indonesia's current situation, there are so many forecasts and predictions the potential of Indonesia in 2045, which is 25 years from now. Many analysis, reports, and forecasts say that by that time, Indonesia would be the top four GDP in the world, which consists of 309 million people, growth of 40 billion from 270 million today, and 52% productive age, and at that time, 75% of people will live in the city, and 80% would be part of the middle class. And in 2045, many forecasts suggested that the income per capita would be $29,000 per year. And we should have the shift toward more productive sectors. So this is Indonesia today, the transformation of the political, social, and economic sectors toward the 2045 with the challenge of how to improve the human capital. Now, let me say something about ASEAN, the U.S. relations. I would like to present this as well as the important and strategic position of Indonesia, because I would like to invite you all to see at the ASEAN as an integrated region rather than just 10 different member countries. ASEAN's today combined economy is the fifth largest in the world with a GDP of $2.8 trillion and still projected to maintain 5.5% growth every year. In terms of trade, ASEAN is the U.S. fourth largest export market after Canada, Mexico, and China, with a total of over $105 billion. And for ASEAN, the U.S. is the fourth largest trading partner. In the agriculture sector, ASEAN is the fourth largest global importer of U.S. agriculture products. And these trade relations support 500,000 jobs across 50 states in the U.S. In terms of investment, the U.S. foreign direct investment in ASEAN has steadily expanded to reach almost $330 billion to date, which exceeds U.S. investment in China, India, Japan, and Korea combined. On the digital economy, ASEAN is the world's fastest growing internet market with 904 million active mobile connections. This is not unusual. In Indonesia and all other ASEAN countries, almost everybody has more than one cell phone. They are very busy. One for family, one for business, and one for other things, so sometimes they got confused themselves. On our travel and tourism, ASEAN visitors to the U.S. have totaled 1.2 million people every year, while 4 million Americans visit ASEAN every year. Now, that mostly are the economic perspective of ASEAN. Now, let me also talk about the strategic and security relations of the two countries. ASEAN and the U.S. Of the two regions. ASEAN and U.S. dialogue relations have continued to strengthen, building upon 42 years of partnership. There have been some important milestones achieved. The elevation of ASEAN-U.S. relations through strategic partnership in 2015, the convening of the special ASEAN-U.S. summit and fourth ASEAN-U.S. summit in the last 2 years, the successful outcomes of the sixth ASEAN-U.S. summit in 2018. The most recent achievement is on the defense cooperation. There is the enhanced Southeast Asia cooperation and training to boost ASEAN maritime security capabilities, working closely with the U.S., and there is a continued defense equipment procurement aimed at enhancing defense equipment and operational interoperability between ASEAN and the U.S. Last on this note, but certainly not the least, is promoting synergy between ASEAN Outlook on Indo-Pacific and the U.S. Strategic Free and Open Indo-Pacific paper. Just last month, the ASEAN summit produced and agreed on the principles of ASEAN Outlook for the Indo-Pacific, which based on the following fundamental principles. First, contribute to maintain peace, freedom, and prosperity. Second, consolidate and develop existing initiatives. Third, ASEAN centrality and ASEAN-led mechanism. Fourth, open and inclusive dialogue. And fifth, areas of cooperation include maritime cooperation and connectivity, and promoting sustainable development goals. And on that note, we welcome the U.S. government's strong support and endorsement on the ASEAN's outlook on the Indo-Pacific. Now, my last part of the remarks is on how Indonesia position and view itself amidst U.S.-China trade situation. Chinese-U.S. trade relations continue to cast a shadow over the global economy, and yet the U.S. administration is addressing what other trading partners have failed to do so, which is to challenge an export-oriented economy whose industry is highly subsidized and relies on devalued currencies. This is not so much a criticism, because it has been an integral part of the overall policy of Chinese development, but it places a considerable burden of trading partners whose industrial base is based on free and fair competition. Indonesia is not immune to these problems, as Indonesia has been experiencing a structural trade deficit with China in the last 20 years. While the WTO rule-based system is intended to defend against the escalation of bound tariffs, the WTO is proving to be ineffective, and as a result, the WTO is no longer the guardian of global trade, and as a consequence, global trade will be increasingly dominated by bilateral deals. As the trade skirmishes between China and U.S. show no sign of abating, with U.S. tariffs moving on to consumer goods, this heralds a new form of global trade where national interests are brought to the table in an effort to promote fair and equitable trade where multilateral trade rules are failing. In fact, the multilateral trading system was intended to encourage fair trade for providing the opportunity for member countries to develop their own comparative advantage in the global economy. But this has not been realized, with substantial structural problems existing, like chronic global overcapacity in many sectors and growing tendency to export unemployment abroad. At the present time, the conditions for a resurgence of the multilateral system is very limited. And while the system still deserves some support in terms of trying to providing certainty of trade, it is unrealistic to expect that the WTO rule-based system can resolve the imbalances being faced. And on that note, we also have to adjust in all aspects of our trade policies and relations between Indonesia and other countries, and also within ASEAN. And on ASEAN, this is what we see happening. The trade skirmishes between China and the U.S. has brought forward U.S. concerns with ASEAN being used as a conduit for Chinese goods, either through transshipments or the relocation of Chinese industries to the ASEAN member countries. As far as the U.S. administration is concerned, there are signs that even fully-fledged Chinese investment in ASEAN could be considered as an attempt to avoid the escalation of U.S. tariffs. And it is likely that higher tariffs applied against China could be extended to the countries concerned. At the ASEAN level, there is a growing concern on how to address an evolving trade skirmishes or war between the two primary trading partners of ASEAN. The problem is, in part, a unity of purpose. Apart from Indonesia, most ASEAN members tend to be export-oriented, and they are therefore keen to take advantage of the vacuum created in the U.S. market. And U.S. importers are likewise looking to ASEAN members to fill the vacuum created by escalating U.S. tariffs on China. This trend will intensify as U.S. moves to consumer goods that are also produced in ASEAN. In the short term, it will be important for ASEAN not to be seen as conduit for Chinese products. This is easier said than done, bearing in mind the close business relations between ASEAN and China, and it's likely that some ASEAN countries may well face U.S. measures moving forward to include the withdrawal of the GSP tariff and the possible escalation of direct tariffs itself. With regard to China, it is strategically an important market for ASEAN as the trade with Europe declines, with the Eurozone remaining close to recession. However, there are growing tensions in ASEAN-China's trade as Chinese exporters compensate for the decline in exports by penetrating regional Asian markets. This will inevitably put pressure on ASEAN industries to use instruments of trade defense against China. This is also quite paradoxical as we resort to WTO instrument of trade defense at a time of WTO weaknesses. However, these instruments are less than perfect in delivering effective protection. There will also be a tendency for ASEAN industry to export excess capacity within ASEAN-owned markets. In this respect, there are already signs of proliferation of anti-dumping cases between ASEAN countries. On Indonesia, amongst ASEAN countries, Indonesia is the largest economy with the largest domestic market. While export-oriented countries tend to embrace the multilateral trading systems, as it is in their vested interest to do so, Indonesia has considerable bilateral leverage with its major trading partners globally and within ASEAN. This is not to say that Indonesia should ignore the multilateral-based system, but bilateral trade relations need to be brought to the forefront of trade policy in the years ahead. On the global trade policy, Indonesia should emerge as a powerful player offering a strong domestic market as an attractive base for the foreign direct investment to penetrate, not only for the Indonesian domestic market, but with the economies of scale that this entails, also the regional ASEAN markets and beyond. Free trade agreements should be negotiated from strength, not so much anymore on access to counterpart markets, which recedes in the importance as global tariffs are already low, but rather how much the potential partners can contribute towards the investment within Indonesia and assisting Indonesia to become a powerhouse within Asia by converting natural resources to downstream value-added industries. Using FTA to access foreign markets is an old and out-of-date paradigm. On the ASEAN trade policy, the overall ASEAN policy is based on consensus, but we are still competing against each other on export markets. But perhaps most importantly, we work on how to attract fellow foreign direct investment ASEAN within ASEAN economies. And central to these policies is how to encourage ASEAN investors to see the Indonesian market as offering economies of scale that exploit the regional markets. On the U.S. trade policy, with regard to that, there is a considerable synergy and potential to develop at the bilateral level as both Indonesia and the U.S. possesses large economies and Indonesia of a lower concern for the U.S. as the ratio of exports to GDP remains low and compared to neighboring countries. In order to lay the grounds for closer cooperation, it is important for Indonesia to be seen as a genuine partner for the U.S. to encourage the growth of trade based on mutual benefits and interests. And for that matter, on the record, out of the 20 countries that have been considered as the cause of the U.S. trade deficit, Indonesia is the only one that has been successfully narrowing it down. There should be a two-way trade and investment with U.S. direct investment flowing into Indonesia, and the more robust Indonesian companies should be encouraged to invest in the economic fabric of the United States. And on the last part, the China trade policy, it is still very important to see China as a strategic partner for Indonesia, and we are mindful not being seen as siding with either part in this trade situation between the U.S. and China. However, Chinese investment into Indonesia should be also considered cautiously with a premium on investment that offer value-added and also export potential to regional markets. Finally, it is by intention I use skirmishes rather than war, because skirmishes you have a situation more limited than the all-out war, and war tend to connotate to be a bigger problem. I'm not suggesting we are going to that situation, but it won't be overcome very soon. With that, I end my presentation. I would be more than happy to have questions from the floor. Thank you very much.
Questions, I invite you to come down to the microphone if possible, unless your voice can reach this far. And then the ambassador will take it from there.
Hi.
Hi.
Looks like it's working. Two questions, if I may. First, I understand that there's a plan to move the capital from Jakarta to Borneo. Maybe you could comment on that. And my second question, what is the current status of RCEP?
The second one?
RCEP, the Regional Cooperative Economic.
Okay. Thank you. Should I answer directly? Okay, sure. On the plan to move capital from Jakarta to Borneo, or we call it Kalimantan, this is, I would say, the first time we look at the possibility with a serious actions to follow it up. Because the consideration of moving the capital to an island outside Java have been discussed even by since the first president, President Sukarno, but it never materialized in the real actions. But we now have a plan for the president to put forward to the parliament to get the parliament support for this move. And if in parallel, there is also a plan to establish a unit, a dedicated unit, to be responsible in the overall plan and the implementation of that for the move. The president has indicated very ambitious timeline. He mentioned about 5 years' time because it is the term of his duty, the second term. But of course, it remains to be seen how effective can we move that process. One of the reasons is, of course, the Jakarta itself is very overly concentrated in terms of everything: population, business, economic hub, logistical hub, and major airports and ports. So that is one. The second one is, of course, there's an issue of sustainability of the city of Jakarta in terms of environmental as well as other sustainable related issues. Jakarta, literally speaking, is sinking considerably every year. Because of the subsided, but because of the exploitation of the groundwater for the, again, overpopulated population. But at the same time, there's another strategic issue to not only put everything on Java, because it's already the most populated and 55% of the population and close to 70% of the country's economy, while the area is just 6% of the total land size. So it's not sustainable in terms of the country's integrity as well as economic development. So these are some of the considerations, and I think the president is very serious on this, and he's been well known as the father of the new infrastructure development. So for him, 5 years, like in the past, he could do a lot in terms of infrastructure construction and investment. So we are hopeful that this could be proceed according to the plan. On the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is basically the FTA plus agreement among the 10 ASEAN members and 6 partners, Japan, Korea, China, India, New Zealand, and Australia. We hope it can be completed and agreed very soon. Some people say it should be completed in the next summit in November this year. The outstanding issue basically is been contained. So that would be very important. And I think by itself is very important because that would be the largest in the world FTA and FTA plus agreement, much larger than even the original TPP. So we are hopeful because not only in addressing the current situation, but because unlike many of the other regions where most of the economies have been developed in such a mature level, in our area it's still very much developing and emerging economies where the room for growth are still abundant. So we are very hopeful it can be done soon, but as you can imagine, it's now facing even a tougher challenge with the global situation. But I have big confidence with our negotiators to overcome that. Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi. So I visited Indonesia a few years ago. I went to Bali with my family. And we went actually for my parents' wedding anniversary. They had gone for their honeymoon 25 years earlier, so we came back. And I had a really great time. And my parents, as we were there for about 2 weeks, my parents kept commenting on how much Bali had developed over 25 years, which obviously has served the Indonesian economy really well. I assume there's similar development all across the country. But I'm curious if you personally or if the people of Indonesia or the government have any concerns about how rapidly things are developing and the growth in the country.
Yeah, especially in Bali, yes.
Yeah.
Certainly. It's a big concern because I think it's very clear that the level of growth and development in Bali is not sustainable in terms of environmental, as well as in terms of socio-political, because it's basically the major concentration of tourism industry, and this is very, very risky of itself because of the issues related to social equality. Socio-economic equalities. Now, to address that, the government has developed a plan for other tourist destinations, including the so-called 10 new or other outside Bali destinations, and 4 of which are very much now in the focus. So we want to do that. But what is different is, of course, Bali is unique also in terms of socio-cultural values. The majority of the population there follow Hinduism, and it's by itself unique, but also it's unique in the sense of how they value and interpret their role and relations with the environment, with the fellow human being, and with gods. So it's quite unique, and of course it's a challenge for other areas to follow suit Bali's example, while everybody recognizes the level of growth in Bali is not sustainable. In terms of infrastructure availability, in terms of the number of hospitality industries and other necessities, there are other parts of Indonesia that already have been developed. But I don't think it's not only about the hard infrastructures. It's also the values and the people. And this is where the challenge and the focus of the programs will rely very much on the success of the other destinations. Now, while foreign or international passengers or visitors are very important, but Indonesia, like the U.S., now also benefit from domestic tourism due to the higher purchasing power of the people, as well as the availability of the affordable airlines or airfares, for that matter. Now, close to 110 million domestic air passengers taking place in Indonesia every year. That puts Indonesia easily in the top 10 busiest air passengers or air traveling in the world. So that is another phenomenon that we would like to promote further, because not only the number of the people, which is very large, but also the importance of Indonesians know and explore their own countries, like here in the U.S., because in the U.S., you can travel through, with cars using the highways, but in Indonesia you have to fly. Of course, you can take sea communication, but our sea transportation system has not developed to accommodate this challenge. But we see the opportunities of the domestic and local tourism are also very significant. So we want to balance between the two. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Ambassador.
Ambassador Siregar, I just want to warmly thank you again for honoring us with your presence. And I wonder if I could embarrass you with a personal question.
I don't know. It depends on the question.
So you've had such an extraordinary career since joining the Indonesian Foreign Service back in 1986. And as your career has developed, you've lived through one of the most dramatic and historic political transitions of every country, of any country on earth. And you have not only risen to every challenge, but you've succeeded at every one, despite this very rapid pace of change in your political system, in your economic system, in your social system. So I was wondering if you could share with us what your secrets of success have been. How have you managed to succeed and prosper through your career of government service?
Well. let me do my best to respond to that question. Well, let's put it this way. What happened 20 years ago in Indonesia, if you look from the pessimistic view, that would be the darkest hour, probably, or years of Indonesia, because we were very much, at least in the modern time of Indonesia, after the 70s. Because after 25 years of, you know, uninterrupted growth of 5 to 7%, suddenly Indonesia was in the brink of a collapse and disintegration. And if you are, or if you were worried about what happened in the Balkans, divided into 6-7 countries, or former Soviet Union countries divided into 15-16 countries, at least you would have a good 50 to 70 countries out of Indonesia if we were disintegrated, because we consist of more than 700 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and more than 300 tribes and ethnicities. So 50, 70 countries already a conservative guess by itself. But if you are an optimistic you know, person, like what I saw at that time, but of course, mostly afterward or the aftermath, crisis is always the best time for reform. Because otherwise, if you have you know, a consideration that crisis is always a big unwanted situation, and that would lead you to one, you will still have to address the crisis anyway. Secondly, you cannot make the most or gain out of the most challenging situation. So we learn a lot from that, because we go beyond the comfort zone of this sustainable economic growth and development to the very much uncharted territory. So that's what happened. And of course, at that time, I was a young person. I also live in Washington, D.C. as the information counselor at the embassy before I moved to other ministries. And you just imagine, before that, I was in London until 1995. At that time, we were part of the so-called the Asian Tigers. And then 3 years after that, Indonesia was, well, almost the pariah of all the global community because of that situation. But I took a different view and look at that. Without that crisis and reform, there would be no more Indonesia today. No more. No way. Because how do you manage and sustain a country with so diversity in an authoritarian rule for so long? 25 years was already so long. How could you sustain that? And now we can easily, like I said, we are the largest presidential democracy in the world, and so on and so on. But of course, even that, we should not take anything for granted. That's why when people share their worries about the current global trade, economic, and political and geopolitical situation, and say, this is the end of the world. Well, obviously, you are sharing a pessimistic view. If you are sharing optimistic view, there's never been a better time like this to reform the global governance. So it's up to you to decide. And for me, now I think for the younger generation, it's easier because they already find a better word than reform, which is called disruption. In the past, reform, you know, you still have a capacity to influence and to direct to a certain extent. In the disruption, you can be totally collapse, or you can become like what happened with many of the young men and women in Silicon Valley. Become instant billionaires. But For me, again, looking at that, it's an opportunity. And now we have even the economists call the president the mother of all disruption. Up to you, which side of the view you are you're taking on this matter. I'm looking at the optimistic view. Why wouldn't I? Because unlike what happened 20 years ago, Indonesia is relatively much, much, much better. And unlike 20 years ago when I was here, Indonesia was the, what I said, unwanted attraction of the world. Now I'm just the spectator. I'm just enjoying the view. Because the attraction or the unwanted center of gravity is on this end. And I'm just given by my government the best ringside seat to enjoy. Why wouldn't I enjoy it? So having said that, like what I tried to explain earlier, Indonesia presents itself as a country and as part of the ASEAN to promote its values, not by force, but by negotiation, by international relations, and by promoting our own interests. And now all the major powers in the world agree that the way to engage and conduct in the region, not only in Southeast Asia, but in the Indo-Pacific, can be done through the eyes of the ASEAN values. This is unbelievable. Because ASEAN is only relatively young compared to NATO or the European Union and others, just celebrating 50 years of its establishment, 52 years. But now, because of that situation, we are, I don't want to say to be cornered, but in fact, we are promoted to become the conductor of the regional peace and stable governance. So how on earth anybody, including you, probably ambassador, 20 years ago, you would be amazed to see ASEAN of itself to have a long-lasting peace in the absence of border wars. But now, ASEAN is expected to play a higher responsibility and role to conduct the regional and, to a certain extent, global governance. You see? And as I said, we are the graduates of the the previous 20 years ago crisis. I think we have something to share in this global situation. So I always welcome that. And for you, after 2001, I left the foreign ministry and I joined 5 other ministries before I resigned in 2015, actually, from the civil servant, because I said 25, 26 years is more than enough for me. And then I went to San Francisco, accompanied my wife, who undertook social entrepreneurship master's class, and at the same time, I co-manage venture capital investing in startup technology investment. Because why I did that? Because I look around and I'm amazed already with the globalization and how the world brings us to this new opportunity. And suddenly, when I was still with the government, I visited Silicon Valley and I said, "Wow, this is outside, out of the world." I would say this is a different world. And then I wanted to know more. And because of that, actually, I resigned from the ministerial job that I had as the investment board chair, because again, 25 years is more than enough. And then I moved to Silicon Valley. Ah, this is the new world. I would enjoy more. But of course, I have so much limited endurance to cope with the 20s and 30s age genius. I don't know where do they come from. And people from all over the world. And when they do the sales speech, selling their companies, I could only understand the first 2 minutes. And then the last, they can only talk of their company of 7-8 minutes. In the last 6 minutes, I got dizzy. Because they are so ingenious, they are so brilliant, they can talk, you know, unlike a normal person, I would say. And then, but still, I enjoy it very much. Then I went back, and then the government asked me to serve for them again. Not easy to refuse government requests if you still want to live in the country.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for that very informative lecture.
Thank you.
And also for the very thoughtful, wise, and optimistic message at the end.
Thank you.
Would you please join me in thanking Mr. Ambassador?
Thank you very much.